Welcome. Welcome at this last session of your Students to Business Day here at Tech Days. I'm going to talk about how you can become an HTML5 developer. Now, basically, the goal of this session today is just to give you enough information so that you can go home, start building the newest applications with the newest bits and bytes of HTML5. Or, for example, to upgrade your existing websites using HTML5. So what are we going to see today? Well, we have to see quite a lot in 15 minutes, but I'm going to do my best to run through all the demos. I'm going to start by talking about what is HTML5 and do we really need HTML5. Then we're going to have a look at the new tags in HTML5, how you can create forms, work with geolocation. We're going to let video play. I'm also going to mention audio, which is basically the same as video, only with a few properties that are not available in audio. We're going to draw some things on the canvas, have a little bit multi-threading with workers, store things on the client side by using data storage. And at the end, if we have time, we're just going to make sure that our web application will be available on a mobile phone too, just by using media queries, which comes with CSS3. Now, basically, why HTML5? Why do we need HTML5? Well, companies nowadays, or people nowadays, want to have application that will run on multiple platforms. In the past, the idea was to create web applications that run on different browsers. But now we have tablets, we have mobile phones, so basically we have to do some more work. Now, if you want to create a mobile application, what are your options today? Well, your options today are, you have a lot of options. If you want to create a Windows Metro application, well, then you need to go for HTML or XAML. Normally, these should be things that you've seen today. If you want to create an iOS application, you need to go for Objective-C. And if you want to go for Android, you need to type some Java code. And there are some tools that I forgot here. For example, BlackBerry is not available on this slide. This also means that if you want to create cross-platform application, that you need to master a lot of technologies. And this is something that you don't have to do with HTML5. HTML5 allows you to create web applications that will run on different machines. So you can create the normal web application by using your browser on the desktop. You can create mobile applications, and also your web applications will work on the tablet as well. So that's the idea of HTML5, to create cross-platform web applications. Now, what is the difference with the slide before? On the slide before, we talked about native technologies. HTML5 is a web application. This means that you cannot use the native features, for example, on an iPad or on a Windows tablet. Now, if you want to do this, and I'm just going to mention it, you can use PhoneGap. PhoneGap allows you to write HTML5 and JavaScript code. And it's a framework that allows you to also access the native features. So basically, you write some HTML5 code, you build it, and then you can run it up to 7 platforms, Windows Phone, iOS, Android, and so on. So this is just to mention inside this session. What is HTML5? Before we go into see some demos, let's first check what HTML5 is. Well, HTML5 is nothing more than a family of new specifications together with some extra JavaScript. Now, why is that combination important? Well, for example, one of the new elements that you have in HTML5 is the video element. Now, if you want to control the video, so you want to start, stop, pause the video, well, then you need to use some JavaScript. So they always come hand in hand. You have a specification, and with that specification, you have some JavaScript. Now, the biggest part for me in HTML5 is maybe not the new elements. It's the JavaScript that comes with the elements that are far more important and far more difficult to write than the normal HTML5 code. We may not forget CSS3, which is different from HTML5, but it's also important to style the HTML5. HTML5 is just having content on your pages, never the user interface related stuff in HTML5. So no inline CSS tags, they should be in external CSS files. Now, we have these new features coming with HTML5. The idea is, what about features that are not implemented in the browser? And so before I can show you a lot of HTML5 demos, we need to make sure that it runs on different browsers. What about, for example, the new tags in HTML5, and my user is using Internet Explorer 7 or Internet Explorer 8? Well, what you should do is, you should check if that feature is available, yes or no. And how can you do this? Well, you can do this in two ways. You can do this the hard way or the manual way in JavaScript. And this is just writing the most hideous code, like create element canvas and trying to get the context. If that works, it is supported. If not, it's not supported. But you can also go for the easy way and the recommended way, and that is via Modernizer. Now, Modernizer is a free library that you can use, and this library will help you detecting if features CSS3 or HTML5 are supported, yes or no. And if you look at the code in Modernizer, you see that it's pretty simple. I can just ask Modernizer, hey, is the canvas supported, or Modernizer, is the video supported? There's just one thing that you shouldn't do. So we talked about feature detection, but never ever do browser detection. A lot of websites don't work because people are checking if the website is, for example, Internet Explorer, or the website is Firefox. This means that you have to target all the browsers in the world, and if suddenly a new browser is going to come out, well, then you have to update your code. So never ever do browser detection. Now, I'm just going to show you a demo with Modernizer to show you how easy it is. And let me go for Visual Studio. It's the other one. Okay, here. Now, this is a Visual Studio, and what I did over here is I created a website. And this website could, for example, be used by a photographer who wants to sell his pictures. So what we see over here is just a few pictures. When I click on it, I have some extra code running to see a nicer look on the picture. Now, what is the problem with this website is, now I'm using Internet Explorer 9, and some of the features that I'm using over here are typically features that comes with HTML5. For example, the header tag, the footer tag, are features that are not available in Internet Explorer 8. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to change the browser mode to Internet Explorer 8, and you see from that moment on, my website does not render perfectly. So to show you how easy it is to fix that with Modernizer, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to drop the Modernizer framework here at the top of my page. That's the only thing that I have to do. Save my page, go back to the page here, press F5. And what you'll see that from now on, this website will also work in Internet Explorer 8. Let's check if it also works in Internet Explorer 7. And yes, it also works in Internet Explorer 7. Just to show you how easy it is to get your website working in older browsers or browsers that do not support these features. So keep Modernizer in mind. If you ever need to do some HTML5 code, that's the first thing that you should do. Okay, so now we can create websites. We can simply load our HTML5 website, and it runs on each browser. Let's have a look at some of the new tags that come with HTML5. Now, I don't have time to see them all, so I just listed them up here on this slide. We're going to see a few of them, like canvas, video, the header tag, and so on. There are also some tags that are removed from HTML. Now, it's not because that they're obsolete that you cannot use them anymore. It's just the HTML5 working group that says, hey, please don't use these tags anymore. If you want to see these tags, just have a look on the W3C site, and there is a page that tells you which elements that are removed from HTML5. Now, the question that I ask myself, how do they come up with these new tags? Is this just a bunch of people sitting in a room and just guessing which feature that they should use? Or is there really a story behind each element? And yes, there is. If you, for example, take a look at how most of the websites in the world look like, it looks like this. You will have a div ID header, somewhere you will have a footer, you will have some content on the side, and you will have some content in the middle. And somewhere there will be a menu as well. Now, just to prove you that I'm not lying over here, I took a site, the Tech Days site, and I had a look at the code. And what you see over there is exactly the things that I just told you. On this site, in this code, you see a div ID header, I have a menu, and I have a footer. So basically, what did the HTML5 working group do? Well, they took those tags, div ID header, div ID footer, and they created real tags out of them. So now you already have a view on the first tags that you have in HTML5 to build the structure of your page. Now, is this important to have tags like header, footer, and so on? Well, yes, that is important. Why? Because now the browser exactly knows where on your page you will have a footer, where on your page you will have your menu. So let's say that, for example, within a few years, if we have smart browsers, let's say, for example, for blind people, and blind people, they don't want to see the footer, they don't want to see the header, they directly want to navigate to the content. Well, the browser now knows that the content sits in an article and sits in a section. So he does not have to bother about what you have in the header and the footer, because now these tags are standards, and each browser should implement it, not now, but in the future, each browser will implement these tags. Now, you cannot have an HTML5 page without forms, without content. So what we're going to do right now is we're going to take that structure and we're going to add a form to that page. Now, if we look back at HTML4 and look at the fields that we have over there, well, HTML4 and the older versions of HTML, they existed out of dumb fields. Now, why do I mean with dumb fields? Well, there were basically simple text boxes, and there was no way that the browser checks the content inside these text boxes. For example, this is the code that you have to write to check whether an email address is correct in that text field. And this is quite stupid, because an email address and a website goes hand in hand. From the moment that we had websites, email addresses came out, so basically they just are two partners of each other. But still, you had to write the most awful code to check whether the email address is correct, yes or no. So what did the HTML5 working group do? Well, they just added a few new input types and few new attributes that should help you creating your HTML5 forms. And I'm going to show you a demo on this. So let's say that, for example, I want to have a page, and on that page I want to have a text box where people can fill out their first name. So normally what you should do in the previous version of HTML, you say, okay, input type text, and that's it. And from that moment, I have a text box and I have my save button. Now, normally when I have a first name or a last name or something like this, it should be a required field. So the next thing that you had to do in HTML4 was writing a lot of code. If the field is filled in, it's okay. If it's not filled in, you're going to show a message. Well, now you have an attribute available, which is required, that easily will do this for you. Just by setting this attribute, when you're going to check whether the field is filled in from the moment that you try to submit your content to the server. So I'm going to run this, click on the save button, and what you will see is that now it says, please fill out this field because it is a required field. I can also have a placeholder. Now, the placeholder is a pretty cool attribute, because that was something that I did a lot in the past. I had to write a lot of JavaScript, but now I can just call the placeholder attribute and say, okay, I want to see your first name here. And from the moment that we do this, you see that the placeholder, your first name, will be filled in. And if we hit the save button, it still is going to complain about the required field, because the placeholder is not the content that you should expect over there. Next thing that I'm going to do, and other focus is pretty simple, I'm not going to cover that one, is pattern. Let's say that the first name, of course, nobody is called number one or number two. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to make sure that only text can be filled in inside that text box. And it should contain more than three letters, for example. Let me bring this here. And if we type now something with numbers, hit the save button, then he's going to say, okay, what you've typed over there is not correct. Please check if the format is correct. Data list is something that doesn't work in Internet Explorer, so what I'm going to do over there is open this in Opera, which is here, and I already have the code over there. So what you see here is I create a data list with some options. Now, what is that data list? Well, it's something that you can use as a sort of autocomplete field, so that when people start typing, then you're going to help them a little bit. And what I did over here is I have a data list with the ID sessions. And I'm just going to mention HTML5 and Metro. And then I'm going to link this data list via the list attribute and just use the ID. So let's run this. And from the moment that we click on it, the autocomplete is going to work, and that's how you can help people completing your field. Okay? As I said, there are also some new elements available. I'm not going to cover them all, but email is pretty straightforward, and that's something that I definitely want to show you because email. I just want to show you that you don't need to write that horrible regular expression code anymore. Let's make this required. Write something that is not an email, hit the save button, and then it's going to ask me, please enter a valid email address. A cool attribute that you can use over there is the multiple attribute, so that you can write multiple email addresses in a comma-separated list. So now it's going to complain, please enter a comma-separated list of email addresses. Another control or element that I can show you here is the input type is number. Let's say the minimum is 2, the maximum is 20. And let's go step 4. There you go. So that is also a control that is pretty useful. Maybe you already know these controls, for example, by using jQuery. The advantage right now is that you don't need to have jQuery anymore to get these things working. And, of course, now they're natively available in HTML5 and in your browser. There are some elements that I cannot show you. Or basically, I can type telephone in here, but on the desktop, it doesn't really make sense. What's the advantage of working, for example, with a telephone element is that when you navigate to this website by using a mobile phone, and the mobile phone is going to see that this field is a telephone, then automatically it will show the telephone keyboard instead of the text keyboard. But this is something that I cannot show you here in this case. Okay, let's go back to the slides. So that are a few of the new types that you can use in HTML5. Okay, the next thing that is interesting, what we saw before was pretty simple, was already almost available in the previous versions. But now what we're going to see right now is new. And that's, first of all, geolocation. What is geolocation? Well, then you can share your location just on your site. You can tell people where you are. Now, this could be, for example, interesting if you use Foursquare. Foursquare can use this technology. Now, basically, how does it work? Well, if you have a mobile phone, you can use the GPS. Now, the good thing is that geolocation also works on my laptop. But my laptop does not have a GPS, so what it's going to do is just going to make use of my IP address, which is not always correct, and hopefully it will be correct right now, because when I was in the speaker's lounge, it worked. When I tested it this afternoon, it didn't work. He told me that it was somewhere in Brussels. So IP address is not always correct, but it's the ID that I want to show you. Now, this is what you have to write in JavaScript. Remember one of the first slides where I explained what HTML5 was? I said HTML5 is a bunch of new specifications together with some JavaScript. Well, this is a JavaScript that belongs to the geolocation. So what you're going to do, and the most important thing is this here. In the navigator, you're going to ask the geolocation to get your current position. And from the moment that he found your current position, he's going to jump into this method, onPositionReady. Now, you can call this method whatever you'd like, but in this case, I call it onPositionReady, and then I fall into this method. And then you have a lot of information that you can ask for. You can ask, okay, what's the latitude, what's the longitude, what's the altitude, and so on. Now, altitude only works with GPS, not with the IP address. But this is the information that you can use, and from the moment that you have your information, you can, for example, use Google Maps, or in this case, Bing Maps, to put a push pin on the map to show you where you are. And this is correct. This is the screenshot that I took in the speaker's lounge. I'm just going to check if it still works. Here, it's the other Visual Studio. And I call the page, where am I? And basically what I do over here is, as I said, I'm going to ask the geolocation to get my current position. From the moment that he found my current position, we're going to jump into this method. And then I'm going to use the Microsoft Maps, the Bing Maps, to put a pin on the screen. So let's run this. Now the first thing that he's going to ask myself is, do you allow to tell where you are? So Internet Explorer is going to ask me, hey, hopefully you see it, it's at the bottom. If the local host wants to track your physical location, I'm going to click on allow once. And it's correct right now. He found me because this is a boulevard de France, so this is correct. I'm sitting somewhere over here. And it's exactly this the case here. So I can zoom out, zoom in. You see it goes pretty neat. Oops. We zoomed out, zoomed in a little bit too much. So that is how geolocation, and it's fairly simple. As what I told you, you just need to ask the object to get your current position, then do some magic with Microsoft Maps, and it will work. By the way, you will find plenty of this code online also to work with Google Maps or whatever. So I would suggest that for Google Maps, you have a look online. The next thing that we're going to have a look at is video and audio. Now, if you would ask a lot of people, what do you know about HTML5? Well, one of the big answers would be is that you can now have natively support for video and audio. Now, the question is, do we really need to have support for video and audio in our browser with HTML5? Because YouTube, Spotify, whatever, already is doing these things for years right now. Well, if you would look at the code that YouTube have to write to get a video working, this is the code that you will find on YouTube. If you would compare this with the code that you have to write now, it's a lot easier. The only thing that you have to ask the browser is, I have a video element, and I want to play this video, which is at this specific source. I want to automatically play the video. I want to see some controls, the width and the height, loop to automatically restart the video, and poster. What is poster? Well, poster is basically when you use video in a browser. Some browsers will show the first frame of the video. And in a lot of cases, the first frame of the video is a black frame. So this is not something that you want to show to your people. So what you can do is you can take a screenshot or you can take an image of your favorite frame in the video and then use this one as an image via the poster attribute. Now I said that I was not going to cover audio. Audio is exactly the same as video, with that difference that you don't have a width, a height, and a poster property. All the other things are exactly the same. Now what is the problem with video is that you have to decide which codec that you're going to use. Now, the HTML5 working group, which is basically a group of people coming from Microsoft, Apple, Nokia, a lot of people coming together, and they were deciding which codec that they should, by default, support. Now, the problem was that a lot of companies already invested a lot of money in specific codecs, while other browsers wanted to use the royalty-free codecs. So basically, now there is no specification. They could not agree on this, which is not that bad. The only thing is that you have to do some more work to get everything working. Now they have a good solution for this, and the solution is this. You're going to have your video tag, and you're just going to list the different codecs that you want to use inside your video tag. So for example, I have first the Big Bug Bunny MP4, then have an AUG format, and then I have the WebM format. Now a small tip here, always put MP4 at the top. Why is that? Well, it's just because of a bug in iPad. iPad only looks at the first line and ignores the other lines. And the only codec that an iPad supports is the MP4 codec. So therefore, you should put the MP4 codec at the top. The other ones, how does a browser work? Well, the browser is going to recognize the video tag, and it's just going to run over these sources one by one until it finds a source that it can use, and from that moment, it's going to use that codec. The last thing inside the video tag is a fallback value. This is a piece of code that you can run when the browser does not support the video. For example, in this case, what we will have is that you will have a paragraph saying your browser does not support the video. Now, what you can do to make it better is something like this. Your fallback value could be a reference to a Flash or a Silverlight video. Of course, the users need to have the plugin installed, but it's just better than showing the text your browser does not support the video. So this is what you should do is provide the sources for the newer browsers, and at the end, embed a Flash video or a Silverlight video at the end so that you will always have that fallback value. Now, the demo on video is pretty simple because it's simple. So now I have the code here, the video code. I'm setting the height. What I'm going to do is I'm going to start playing the video from the moment that it loads. So I'm going to set the autoplay attribute. And there you go. And this is the video of Big Bug Bunny. At this point in time, I don't have controls. So what I want to, what I need to do to get the controls over there is use this attribute, and now I have the controls inside the video. Now, it could be that these controls look differently in Internet Explorer, as in Chrome, as in Opera. Each browser can decide how these controls look like, but the idea is the same. You have a play button, you have a pause button, you can rewind, you can fast forward, and so on. That's it. As I said, the demo on video is going to be very short because that's the only thing that you should do. Have a video tag, set the autoplay controls, provide your sources and your fallback value. Okay. Now let's get to the more interesting part, which is the canvas. Now the canvas is my number one new feature in HTML5 because it allows me to do a lot of things. Now the easiest thing to compare a canvas with is just an empty space on your screen where you can put in drawings, videos, images, whatever you'd like. Everything can be put inside that canvas. Now, how do you create the canvas on your screen? Well, the code is as simple as what we saw with the video. It's just have a canvas, set the width and the height, and have a fallback value if your browser does not support the canvas. That's it. Now, the easiest thing to compare the canvas with is with Microsoft Paint. What you do over there is you're going to make drawings, and you're just going to make use of the tools that MS Paint gives you. For example, if I want to draw a line, I use one of these tools, and I pick a color at the top. So that is how you can compare the canvas easily with. It's with Microsoft Paint. Now, before you can draw things on the canvas, you need to get the rendering context. Now, how do you do this? Well, you're just going to ask the canvas via the getContext method, give me the rendering context. And in this case, I'm using 2D. You will also see that there will be some 3D games as well using the canvas. If you have time, you should have a look at the worldbiggestpacman.com, which is hundreds of hours fun playing Pac-Man using the canvas in HTML5, which we're not going to do. Now, as I said, if you want to draw on the canvas, you need to compare it with Microsoft Paint. So if I want to draw a line, what you're going to do is you're just going to tell the context, I'm going to begin drawing a path, and first I will move to a specific point on my canvas, and then I'm going to draw a line. That's how simple it is to create a line. If you want to create a triangle, then you draw two lines, and then you're just going to fill it up with a specific color. If you want to draw a rectangle, then you call the stroke rect, if you only want to see the stroke. If you want to fill the rectangle up with a color, then you need to call context.fillRect. And the parameters that you see over here is 20 pixels from the left, 20 pixels from the top. It should have a width of 200 and a height of 270. So these are the things that you have to do to get drawings on the canvas. It's not that easy. Because if you would look at how many lines of code it would take you to get a real drawing in the canvas, it's quite a lot of lines of code. So my guess will be is that the canvas will be much more interesting from the moment that you have good tools that where you can make drawings like in Illustrator or whatever, and that tool will generate the code for you. From that moment, a lot of things will be possible with the canvas. Now, with a canvas, you can do two things. You can use the canvas for professional reasons. For example, what you see here is a chart created with a canvas. You see that we made use of the rectangles, of lines, but also of text. You can use the draw text method to get text on your page. And then, in this case, this one here, the widgets produced, is using the draw text and then use the rotate transformation on the canvas to get the text vertically. Other people will use the canvas to make games, going from simple games to the more advanced games. But this is just the typical the sort of web developer that you are. Are you more interested in the game section, then you will do a lot of things like this, which is a lot more difficult than doing the professional things with the canvas. Now, what I'm going to show you as a demo is I'm going to put an image inside the canvas, and then I'm going to invert the pixels. I don't know why you should do this in your life, but at least I'm going to show it. So go here. And I have a lot of place here. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to draw a rectangle. And if you want to draw a rectangle, then you need to first pick a color. So I'm going to make a white rectangle. So I'm going to set the stroke style. And I'm going to use a white color. I'm going to say that the width of my lines will be 20. And the place where the lines are going to come together, I'm going to set it to round so that we have round edges. And let's just draw the rectangle. So 20 pixels from the left, 20 pixels from the top. Let's go for 270 for the width. Oops. And 390 for the height. So there you go. Now I have already a rectangle on my page. The next thing that I need to do is I need to put an image inside that rectangle. So I'm going to create an image. Image. I'm going to set the source of the image. It's an image.jpg that sits in the image folder. Okay, and from the moment that the image is loaded, then I'm going to run this function. And in this function, I can only put that image inside the canvas when the image is loaded. So I need to check whether the image is loaded, yes or no. And then we're going to put that image via the draw image function of the context. I want to see the image 30 pixels from the left because I have that border, 30 pixels from the top, 250, 370. And now I have an image in my rectangle. So that's the code that you need to write. As I said, it's not the most simple code, but yeah, as a web developer and as a JavaScript lover, this is the code that you love to write. Now, what you can do with this image, now this is a method that does not come standard with the canvas. It's a method that I did, and hopefully it's visible here, is to put an image in black and white. What I did over there is I ran over each pixel, and I used an algorithm to just change it into a grayscale. Now, to show you how this works, it's quite a lot of code, so I'm going to use a snippet. Invert pixels snippet. There you go. So this is exactly the same code as I've written before. This is exactly the same code as I've written before. The only difference is that now I'm calling a method invertPixels, and we jump into this method. And what happens here is I can ask the context to get me all the information about that image. And if I want to run over the pixels, I need to get a reference to that array of pixels, and that is how I can do this. Out of the image data, give me the data from the data property. This is going to give me an array of pixels. And then I can use the simple for loop to run over each pixel, change the red color, change the green color, change the blue color. And what we have at that point in time is that I just inverted the pixels. Now, to show you, this is the red and the green. I put this in comments. Probably need to clear my image. Oh, I have a mistake here. Actually, this is the red color. This is the green color. Now, I saw some demos online where they are basically having a lot of same features as what Photoshop has, but simple as a web application. So the canvas has a lot of possibilities. What I did over here was with an image, I can do exactly the same with a video. So that's, again, my Big Bug Bunny video. And what I'm doing over here is run over each pixel and have that same algorithm to put my picture in black and white. And I now have it done on the video as well. So there are a lot of possibilities here. Another example is this one. It's not one that I created, sadly, but I think it's pretty cool. Is in a canvas. Let me go for Deep Force Rain. This is totally done with a canvas. And what you see over here is that I have a lot of pictures. And for example, if I select this color on the right, then it's going to run over the canvas and check where this color occurs on this image or this drawing. And basically, this is almost the same as what I did. Just run over each pixel and check whether the color is the same as what I have selected here on the right. So a lot of things are possible with a canvas, and for that reason, it's one of my favorite features inside HTML5. Okay, now the canvas was cool. The next thing is something maybe not that cool, but it's quite amazing, because if a lot of people would told me a few years ago, Kevin, with HTML5, you will be able to work multi-threaded with JavaScript, I would never believe that people. But it's true. What you can do right now is you can have a JavaScript running in the background so it won't block your user interface thread. Now, why is this ideal? Well, for example, if you have to do a lot of calculations, do it at the background. If you need to get some data and you don't want to affect your user interface thread, for example, load RSS feeds or whatever, you can do this in the background thread. Now, there are some restrictions. Not everything is possible. For example, you cannot talk to the document object. So a document.getElementById is not possible. You don't have access to the window object, and you cannot talk to the page. The code that you have to write to get it working is pretty simple. What you do is you're going to create a new worker, and the script that you want to run on the background, you're going to pass that as a parameter while you're creating your new worker. To start the worker, you call the postMessage method. Then from the moment that the worker is working, and at some point in time it's going to come back, and if it worked, it will call the onMessage method. If there was an error, it's going to call the onError method. In the worker itself, what you need to do is you need to add an event listener. And from the moment, on the previous slide, I just showed you that you need to call the post message. So the thing that you're going to bring to the worker is a message. From the moment that a message is going to come in, this method, in this case, message handler, will be executed. So your heavy stuff should be inside this method here. Now, to show that to you with a demo. Now, for example, this is something that I've written before, is to calculate Fibonacci without workers. And if you have a small amount of numbers, it's pretty easy. He doesn't have to think about it. When I have a bigger number, you will see, and look at the progress bar here, that my UI thread will be blocked. So now my browser is only calculating the Fibonacci values, and at the end, from the moment that he calculates them, he's going to come back. Now, that's not a good idea. What you should do is you should work with workers. And basically what happens is that I'm going to do exactly the same. I'm going to calculate a Fibonacci of 40. And what you see right now is that my browser is not stuck. It's calculating the Fibonacci values, but I can still do other things with my browser. Now, how does this work? Let me go to Visual Studio. It's basically, this is the code, and it's code, it doesn't matter what's inside of it, but it's to generate the Fibonacci. And this is the reason why my website will slow down, because I'm doing some horrible calculations over here. Now, what I'm going to do to solve that problem is I'm going to copy this code, generate Fibonacci, and calculate next Fibonacci value into an external JavaScript file. And I didn't change the code. It's exactly the same code. But now, in the other page, what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a worker. I'm going to link to that Fibonacci file. From the moment that my worker is done, I'm going to call this method, message handler. When there is an error, I'm going to call the other method. And the only thing that I need to do to get this worker ready and work is call the post message method. Then automatically it will jump into that event listener. It gets its message. It will jump to the message handler, and in the message handler, I just call the generate Fibonacci. So that's the only thing that you need to do, and it's quite amazing. It doesn't work in all the browsers yet, so it doesn't work in Internet Explorer, but in Internet Explorer 10, it already works. So it's definitely something that you can use in the next version. Another example is this one, which is something that you can find online. And in this page, what it's going to do is just going to find a root inside this Google page. Now, if I do this with workers, my user interface is not blocked. I can still do everything, whatever I want. I can zoom in, I can zoom out. And he's working. As you can see here, he's loading the root, but I can do whatever I like. Hopefully it goes a little bit faster because I want to click on the other button. Come on. Okay, there we have the root. I'm going to do exactly the same right now, clicking on the other button, and you will see that my Google Chrome will be stuck for a moment. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm not going to wait until it comes back. I'm just going to continue with the slides. Otherwise, we're going to lose a lot of precious time. But I'm going to click on it, and now my Google Chrome is stuck. I cannot even press the... Oh, I can. Oh, okay, not anymore. It's stuck. I press the F11 button. doesn't work. Basically, whether you believe me or not, you don't see me pressing it, but I'm pressing the F11 button. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to continue with the slides. The next thing that we're going to have a look at, and which is quite interesting in HTML5, is web storage. But before I'm going to explain what web storage is, let's go back and have a look at the previous version and how do you save things on the client side in HTML4 or before that. Well, you're going to do this with cookies. The only problem with cookies is that although that they only contain information that sits on the client side, a cookie always gets carried to the server and back again. So this means that you're losing a lot of bandwidth, you're losing a lot of network that could be very valuable for other things that you want to do on your website. So what's the thing that you have to do to solve this? Well, you have two options. You have web storage and you have IndexedDB. Now, we're not going to cover IndexedDB, I'm just going to tell you what it is. IndexedDB is a database attached to your browser. Now, you can compare it, for example, with SQL Server. With that difference is that you don't have to write SQL. To store things and to get things out of that index database, you do this, again, with one of the JavaScript APIs. And it's something like put data, create object store, and so on. What we're going to cover is web storage, and more in detail, local storage and session storage. Now, what is the difference between the two? Well, basically, they do exactly the same. But when you store something in the session storage, it will only be available for that window and as long as that window is alive. So from the moment that you close the window, then your information is gone. You cannot get it anymore. Local storage is exactly the same, but the information is stored on the machine itself. So when you close your window, you go to Australia for 3 weeks, you come back, open up your, open that website again, that information will still be available because you use the local storage. So it is persisted on the local machine. Now to show you how that works, it's done right now, okay, so that's good. Okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to write code to put something in the local storage. Now, it's pretty simple. The only thing that you need to do is call the local storage and call the setItem method. And then you need to give in a key value pair. So the only thing that you need to be aware of, you can only put strings inside that local storage. What you could do, for example, you cannot store images in there. You could store the URL to an image, but the image itself cannot be stored in there. If you, for example, want to store an array, and that's something that I'm going to show you in a minute, then you need to store that array as a JSON object. Don't do a set item, give it a name, for example, demo. And then create a new array. That will not work. You need to change it to a JSON object, but that's something that I'm going to show in a minute. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to store something in there, demo tech days, students do business. That's it. And then we're going to have an alert saying that stored in the local storage. Okay. It's stored in the local storage. I have a spelling mistake, but it doesn't matter. What I'm going to do is I'm going to now open up a new tab inside the same browser, and let me copy this code to save some time. I'm going to write an alert, and I'm going to get the item. And we just want to get the value, so I'm going to get rid of this. Okay, and then we're going to alert it. And what you see over there is just got the information from the local storage and just display this in an alert. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to copy this code. Open up, we need to have the URL. Here, same page, get this information. Paste that over there. run this code, and you see that although that I'm in another window, I still can have that information. And this would something, when I would use session storage, it would not work, because session storage belongs to that window in the browser. It's always per browser. So if I would run this code, let's say in Internet Explorer or Opera, it won't work, because the local storage belongs to the browser and not, for example, for all the browsers. The reason for this is because each browser can has its own space on the local file system, and that's different for all the browsers. So for that reason, it's always per browser, but you can already use this in multiple windows. Now, why is this handy? One of the things that I use is, for sometimes you go to websites and you start buying things. For example, if we go to this here, when I'm going to go back to that photographer page. And a lot of websites, you have a shopping cart. But the problem with that shopping cart is that the shopping cart is always on another page. So it's sometimes handy that you can buy things, and in another window, you can see everything that you just bought. Well, this is something that you can do with local storage. Save everything, not in a cookie, but in the local storage. Just open the other page and read out of that local storage. So, for example, what you see over here is a page where you can select images, and you can click on the buy button if you want to buy that image, yes or no. Now, of course, when I buy images and I would open up that same page inside another Internet Explorer in this case, it should work. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to click on the buy. I'm going to buy these three images, copy the URL, open up a new browser. And when you see that, I use the local storage, so these three images are marked as being bought. So that's one of the handy things of local storage, to share data across multiple windows. Session storage is always per window, so for that reason, I tend to use the local storage more than the session storage, but I can imagine that you will find some reasons to use the session storage as well. Okay, let's go back. So you just saw the site that we've created with the pictures. It looked like this. Now, as I said, I want to round this up by making our website also available on a mobile phone. So what did I do? I just did a check, and that site on a mobile phone looks like this. Now, the problem with this is that a lot of relevant information is not available on the mobile phone. For example, I don't see the menu. The menu sits somewhere on the right, so I have to swipe through the content to see the menu. Another thing is that these buttons, on a mobile phone you use your finger, these buttons are too small to buy the pictures. So that these are a lot of reasons why this is not a good site on a mobile phone. Now the question is it a big deal? Well, yes, it is a big deal. Because at this point in time, there are about 7 billion people in the world who have a mobile phone. And as you can see on the chart, almost a quarter of those people are connected on the internet with their mobile phone. This means that within a few years, the chances are very big that people with mobile phones will navigate to your site. And if your content is not adapted to that device, then you will lose a lot of visitors to your site. So a solution for this is responsive web design. Now, responsive web design, as the word it says, what you're going to do is you're going to make a website that will react on the device that your visitor is using. So if people with a mobile phone is going to visit your site, you're just going to get the correct content and show them that content. For example, maybe don't show the footer, because that's not interesting at that moment in time. Now, it is so, and I have to be honest, I don't do it like that as well. It's easier to start creating your website with the idea of a mobile phone and then to scale out to a desktop version than the other way around. Now, this is a problem for me, because all the existing websites, they are created to be viewed on the desktop. So I have a lot of work to get them working on a mobile phone as well. But for all the new sites that you're going to create, think first of mobile and then grow to desktop. That's a good tip that I'm going to give you. Now, how can you do this in HTML5? Why not? Why not? Because I told you in the beginning of this session that user interface related stuff should be done with CSS3. Not with HTML. HTML is only to deliver content. JavaScript is to add behavior. CSS is to do the user interface related stuff. So if you want to do responsive web design, go for media queries. And media queries is a technology that comes with CSS3. Now, what are media queries? Well, pretty simple. Media queries just means that you're going to write CSS for different devices. But the same as what I said about don't do browser detection, you're not going to do device detection, if that would exist. No, you're going to work based on properties of that device. So in my case, what I'm going to do is I'm going to create or write CSS based on the screen resolution. Because mobile phones have a smaller resolution than, for example, the desktop versions or a tablet version. And this is an example of such a site where you see that the content reacts based on the screen resolution of that site. Another good example, and that's maybe a site that you're going to see in the future, is the job ad site. And from the moment that I'm going to make my resolution smaller, you will see that the website will react based on the screen resolution. So this is what we call responsive web design. And this is the version that you would see on your mobile phone, while on the desktop you have more space, so you can show more content. So also with responsive web design, you have to come back and think of what's the most important content on my page and only show that content and get rid of all the other things. Now, the code, how do you do this media queries? Well, first of all, you start writing, for example, the CSS code for your desktop. And at the end, you're going to write the CSS code for another device. So what you see here at the top is that I'm using the add media tag. This is just going to tell the browser, hey, we're going to work with a media query over here, which is going to work on the screen. And this is my expression. And to work with media queries, it should give a yes. Media queries only work when this expression gives a true or yes. And from the moment that my maximum width of my browser is smaller than 480, it will use this CSS instead of the normal CSS that you would use in the desktop. So what I'm going to do is, on this page, the pictures page, that when I'm going to make my page smaller, I want to have the menu on the left, and I want to get rid of this header because at that moment in time, that header is not so important on a mobile phone. And I'm going to make these buttons bigger so that I can use my finger on a mobile phone to buy pictures. Now to do this, I already written the code, is I'm going to write a media query in the CSS file, and I'm going to work with a maximum width of 600 pixels. And when we go smaller than this, my menu, navigation is the standard for your menu on the screen. I'm just going to say that it should be on the left. Other things that I'm going to do is just I'm going to make my images bigger. So I think if we would look at the normal code, it will be smaller than this. So I'm going to make it bigger to 210 pixels. So now when I'm going to make my screen smaller, this is 600 pixels. You see that from the moment that I go smaller than this, my menu gets on the left, my pictures are bigger, because on the Windows phone or on a mobile phone, I don't need to see two pictures next to each other. I don't have the place, so I can make them bigger, and my button is bigger as well, so I can use my finger to buy these specific buttons. This is responsive web design, and this is what you always should do when you want to create your own websites, but first think mobile, and then think about scaling out, making your websites bigger. Okay, so these are the topics that I wanted to see with you. But before I'm going to let you go, let's have a look at the resources. What you should know to start making HTML5 applications. Well, first of all, IE10, and you will have a website, ietestdrive.com, where you will find a lot of examples that you can use. For example, what you see over here is the drag and drop API. You will also see some JavaScript and Canvas functionalities. You will have some professional things as well. You have video samples. So you will find a lot of information over there. Another website that you should check is the HTML5 working group website of W3C. And at the bottom, hopefully you can all see it, you will see that this is still a work in progress. Again, HTML5 is not ready. Some features don't work in all the browsers, but we saw with Modernizer and with feature detection how we can solve that. The best site for me is dive into html5.info. This contains all the information that you need to know about HTML5. And the good thing is you don't need to buy a book. Now, everybody who has written a book on HTML5 is going to kill me right now. But this is an online, free online version with a lot of great samples, links to demos and so on. So just check to this site, dive into HTML5. And with that, I'm going to end this session. If we have time for one question, I will be happy to answer that question. If you want to have more questions, just come forward and just ask. Okay? So thank you very much for listening, and have a safe trip back. Okay.